I'm Robin Osborne, another member of the Home Team, and it's my pleasure to introduce the second plenary lecture. Walter Ease Dickerson, Professor of the Humanities and Professor of Classics at Stanford University. But actually, in the spring of this year, he's been in the pay of New York University as Global Professor at New York University, Abu Dhabi. You can see Walter has a taste for exotic places. He also has a taste for giving us unshuttered views of the ancient world. We're particularly affected by the way in which he has removed the shutters from ancient demography, from ancient economic history, and from the study of ancient slavery. And I, at least, am much looking forward this morning to him removing the shutters from the emperor in the Roman world. Walter.
Well, thank you very much, Robin, for this kind introduction. Thanks also to Simon Goldhill for inviting me to give this lecture, to the Institute for the Study of the Ancient World for its sponsorship. I'm going to talk about Roman emperors. Now, Roman emperors are still a pretty popular subject, as far as I can tell. Lots of books are still being written. The title of my own lecture, of course, being a reference to Fergus Miller's famous book, The Emperor in the Roman World, published 34 years ago. But the flow of books continues unabated. Sometimes Roman emperors still produce a large turnout. Sometimes I'm told even large book advances, but only if you're a famous blogger. So I thought if I gave a lecture on the same topic, maybe good things would happen to me too. That's my hope for today. However, what I'm interested in primarily is not Roman emperors per se. I'm more interested in using the study of Roman emperors to illustrate, to demonstrate a rather important methodological point about how we ought to do ancient history. Now, I'm not the first person to use the study of Roman emperors to make a point about method. In fact, Fergus Miller, in his famous book 34 years ago, very forcefully took a stance, urging people to study Roman emperors based entirely on sources from the Roman period, excluding other materials. Now, this at the time provoked an equally forceful response by Keith Hopkins, who called for a deliberate application of concepts, ideas, theories, models, insights derived from other disciplines, especially the social sciences, using them to make sense of the Roman evidence and especially to formulate questions that really matter and then devise ways of addressing those questions. Now, it seems to me that this debate left out a rather important bit. We don't just face a choice between sticking to Roman sources on the one hand and transdisciplinary work on the other. What we also need is more awareness of simple facts, data, evidence, information from beyond the Roman world. Every time you study a case, let's see, as a species of a particular genus, it makes a lot of sense to look at other species of the same genus as well. So if you want to know about Roman emperors and understand that phenomenon, well, it's certainly a good idea to look at other monarchies as well. In fact, we are never really able to figure out to determine what mattered in the history of Roman emperors, what was common, uncommon, anomalous, maybe even unique, unless we engage in explicit systematic historical comparison. And much the same is true for addressing the questions that arise from this kind of comparative perspective. So my paper today is really just a straightforward plea for the importance of comparative history. Not a comparative history that's just an optional supplement, some kind of add-on to business as usual, but a comparative history that's absolutely central to whatever we study as ancient historians or historians in general. Now, there are certainly many features of the Roman monarchy that would benefit from a comparative perspective. And if I'd been given 2 or 3 hours and you didn't want to have lunch, I could elaborate on this for quite some time. But since I only have less than an hour, I'm going to focus on just one aspect of the Roman monarchy, which is continuity. There are two reasons, at least two reasons for doing this. One is, if you open any book on the history of some monarchy somewhere in the world, it will usually be organized, structured in terms of dynasties, in terms of kin-based lines of succession. And the other reason is that rulers don't just want to hold on to their power and maximize it. Well, given the limits on the human lifespan, they also aim to pass power on eventually to someone of their own choosing, preferably to very close kin, ideally in most systems, to their own son. That's, of course, a preference that is truly pervasive throughout world history. We can see it on all the continents that have produced monarchies over thousands of years. In fact, it's a preference that continues all the way up to the present day. Even in systems that are not officially classified as monarchies, but effectively function as such. Now, this pervasiveness is not really surprising, given that it's ultimately rooted in genetics, in people's innate preference for very close kin. Now, this pervasiveness makes it all the more surprising that the Roman monarchy is a genuine outlier in this respect. In a nutshell, my argument today, my claim, is that Roman monarchy as a whole, in its entirety, was dramatically different from all other monarchies in world history. That's the summary of my argument. They were totally different from other monarchies in world history in two terms with respect to the level of violent turnover, the churn within the system, and even more significantly, in terms of the lack of dynastic continuity. And that really sets them apart from all other systems. Now, when I say Rome in its entirety, I mean the 1500-year sweep of Roman history, from Augustus to Constantine the 11th, who was killed when the Turks took Constantinople in 1453. I will, where appropriate, distinguish between what we usually think of as the Roman Empire and the Byzantine period, but I'm really trying to look at the entire phenomenon and make claims about the system as a whole. Now, that means that my claim is a very big claim, but it has the advantage of being empirically testable. It is actually susceptible to verification or falsification, but only through systematic historical comparison. The main point really is that we wouldn't even be able to identify this phenomenon as such, as a world historical anomaly, were it not for historical comparison and contextualization. And of course, much the same is true of attempts to then explain this particular phenomenon. So my procedure today is very simple. In the first step, I will try, hopefully to your satisfaction, to establish the factual truth of the claim that I've made. And then in the second step, I'll briefly at the end suggest some possible causal explanations for the observed phenomenon. And of course, as I said, both steps rely critically on historical comparison. Now, the first question is, how can I really be sure that my claim of Roman exceptionalism is true? If I claim that the Roman monarchy is different from all other monarchies in world history, well, what I would have to do is to look at data from all adequately documented monarchies in world history. Now, when you get invited by Simon to give a lecture to such a large and distinguished audience, you want to be absolutely sure. So this is what I did. I looked at evidence from 31 major monarchies in world history on four continents, Europe, Asia, Africa, and the pre-Columbian Americas. They go back, in the case of Egypt, almost 5,000 years, and in some cases up to 1900 AD, which was my cutoff point for those monarchies that have persisted into the more recent past. I have to say, there are, of course, more monarchies out there in history, and I've looked at many of those too, but they are, if they're not included, they're not adequately documented. Yeah, you can't do the same kind of analysis that I'm trying to do in my survey here. Now, those 31 systems produced a total of 1,596 rulers who ruled for a total of 24,415 years. I should say that you're not supposed to be able to read this slide. This is just a symbolic attempt to pull data together from all the various data sets and subsets that I've been using to sort of make a gesture indicating that I've really done the work that I just claimed to have done. Now, what all these 1,596 rulers have in common is that for each of them, we know how long they ruled, how many days, months, and years. In most cases, we have information about their genealogical status, how they were related to their immediate successors and immediate to their predecessors and successors. And in most cases, we have information about the circumstances in which their reigns ended, whether they died of natural causes or whether they were forcibly removed from power. Those are the two main alternatives, with very few exceptions. Now, in this survey, I focus on two variables, which is violence and continuity. Violence is best defined by what I euphemistically call the rate of premature termination. The rate of premature termination measures for any given system the percentage of rulers who were removed from power against their will, in most cases through assassination, but in a minority of cases by being driven to suicide, deposed, or killed in civil war combat. Now, the best proxy data we have for this kind of violent termination rate is in fact the average duration of the reigns of rulers. So if you look at this data set, you find that the data naturally cluster into a rather small number of subsets. At the right end, you get the average duration of reigns in some of the major European monarchies, by which I mean post-Roman Christian European monarchies. And you can see rulers on average last for a pretty long time, about 20 years on average. By far the largest group are people in the category Eastern, which is not easy to label. Most of these cases are from Asia, a few from Africa, and the pre-Columbian Americas. It's essentially a global pattern outside Europe. And here you can see you have a wider range, but the average is clearly lower. It's more like 15 years on average. And if you look at Hellenistic monarchies, the upper dot are the Ptolemies and the lower one the Seleucids. And in the case of Rome, Byzantium rulers last for about 14 years. And in the standard Roman Empire from Augustus to Theodosius for the first four centuries, they only last on average 7 years, which is half of the world historical average of 15 years or one-third of the average for later post-Roman Christian Europe. Now, this systematic difference is caused by a single factor. It's not due to differences in health or other issues. It's almost entirely a function of levels of violence. You can see this in this chart, which is the inverse almost of the chart I showed you earlier. It measures the incidence of premature termination, the percentage of rulers forcibly removed from power by their own people. And you can see in the case of Europe, the rate is pretty low. It's between 10 and 25%, which seems like a lot by historical standards. It's actually fairly modest. Again, in the global or Eastern model, you have a wider spread, but most cases fall between 30 and 50% of all rulers being forcibly removed from power. Now, the Hellenistic states are not doing very well. You have the Ptolemies at 50%, the Seleucids at more than 70%. And on the left-hand side, Byzantium at about 45%, and two-thirds of all Roman emperors in the first four centuries of the monarchy are forcibly removed from power. So these are exceptionally high rates, as you can see at a glance. It's also very easy to show the correlation between levels of violence and the mean duration of rulers' reigns. If you look at the bottom of the chart, you see in Europe, on average, about 20% of rulers are forcibly removed from power, and as a result, they on average last a pretty long time, about 20 years. And if you look at the top, you see that, well, two-thirds of all rulers, more than three times as many, are forcibly removed from power, and as a result, on average, they last only a third as long as kings do in Europe. And all the other monarchies are somewhere along a spectrum in between those two extremes. So clearly the Romans are doing rather poorly. Now, as for continuity, there is no single straightforward way of measuring dynastic continuity. There are several different, this is for the statistically minded, if there are any in the audience, simply formally showing the relationship between levels of violence and the mean duration of reign. As systems get more violent, as you move to the right-hand side of the chart, the average duration of reigns goes down. The statistical correlation is very strong. Over 80% of this variation is explained with reference to levels of violence. It's a very straightforward relationship. Now, as I said, continuity is more difficult to measure. There are various ways of doing this. If you look at the first column, you can measure the percentage of rulers who are succeeded by their own children, by their biological children. And in many monarchies, that's very often the case, 50, 60, 70% of all cases. Then you can look at what percentage of rulers are succeeded by siblings. That's a mode of succession that's quite popular in some parts of the world, especially the Middle East, up to the present day. Well, the best measure, of course, is to combine those two and measure the proportion of rulers who are succeeded either by a child or a sibling. And these rates are uniformly very high, between 50 and 90%. And then you can expand the definition even further. You can include succession by nephews, cousins, grandchildren, and so on. And if you do that, well, you get really high rates throughout, between 85 and 100%. Now, another way of doing this is by looking at the proportion of rulers who were totally unrelated to their immediate predecessors, not even by adoption or as in-laws. And you see, in most cases, sometimes it's 0%. It's never even as many as 10%. It's only a few percent of all cases in all these monarchies. On the other hand, if you look at the lower right-hand corner, you see immediately that in the case of Roman history, no matter how you slice it up, a very high proportion of all rulers are completely unrelated to their immediate predecessors. Again, this is easier to understand in a visual format. You can see that the blue cases is the incidence of succession by complete outsiders, by unconnected individuals. It's always less than 10%. Well, in the case of Byzantium, almost a third of all rulers are unconnected to their predecessors. In Rome, more than 50% of rulers are completely unconnected to their predecessors. If you look at the Roman average, it's an entire order of magnitude higher than for the European monarchies. So the Roman case is dramatically different in this respect. Now, before I go on about Roman history more specifically, I want to draw attention to a global pattern that emerged while I was doing this survey. In fact, there's no law that says ancient historians doing comparative history can't find out stuff about cases other than Rome. There are lots of benefits to this comparative approach. What emerges from this kind of global survey is that outside Rome, there are only really two different types of monarchical succession in world history. The one type, which is by far the most common one, which is why I call it the global default model, is found everywhere outside Europe, in Asia, Africa, the pre-Columbian Americas, and so on. What you have in those situations in this model is that rulers are to varying degrees polygynous. This has two major consequences. One is this generates a great deal of demographic resilience, of demographic depth. There are simply more people in the line who are kin of the ruling family. But we also know that polygyny endogenously generates a lot of violence. There's a lot of violent competition among all these potential heirs and their various mothers, which are linked to the ruler and so on. Sometimes this takes extreme forms, like in Mughal India, where all the potential heirs have to fight it out when the ruler dies or among the Ottomans. In other cases, it's more muted, but it's consistently an observed outcome, and that often spills over to affect sitting rulers as well. This is why the rate of assassination in polygynous regimes is much higher than it is in Europe. Now, essentially, you have a combination of two variables. You have high output in terms of lots of children and high wastage at the same time. But this high wastage is offset by high output, resulting in a great deal of dynastic continuity. So, you know, whenever the dust settles, odds are there's always someone left standing to continue the ruling family, to continue the dynasty. So that's a stable equilibrium pattern. The only alternative to this is the post-Roman European pattern, where rulers are subject to prescriptive serial monogamy, which has any number of reasons. Now, this generates two different outcomes. One is more demographic fragility. There are fewer people around in the next generation to continue the dynasty, but at the same time, there's less violence. So you have a different equilibrium of low output and low wastage. And that, in turn, generates the exact same outcome. There are two ways of attaining the same outcome. There's no difference in the average duration of dynasties in type 1 and in type B. Type 2, they're just two different sustainable combinations that yield the same result. The only exception being Rome. This recapitulates some of the same data. You see at the bottom the European monarchies, low levels of violence, and as a result, a high degree of biological relatedness of dynastic continuity. Then you have the Asian monarchies with higher levels of violence, but more resilience, and likewise, higher levels of continuity. Now, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies are probably following Daniel Ogden, best classified as, to varying degrees, effectively polygynous. So they're actually part of this global default model. They experience very high levels of violence, but they're able to sustain dynasties for several centuries. The only people who are different are the Roman monarchs, because what the Romans do is they have a very dysfunctional combination of two logically incompatible variables. They, as being prescriptively monogamous, have relatively low output, not that many children, but they experience very high levels of violence. So you have low output, high wastage. And in that scenario, it's simply impossible to sustain dynastic continuity. That's not a feasible outcome in this particular case. Now, in that sense, I should say Rome is not just uncommon, it's absolutely unique in world historical terms. The only regime that found that shares superficial similarities is the Mamluk Sultanate in late medieval Egypt. But it's very different because the Mamluk elite actively discourages dynastic succession, and many rulers start out as purchased slaves who are acquired by the Mamluk elite in order to occupy positions of authority. That's obviously rather different from the Roman case, but it's striking in itself that the closest analogy to the Roman case is something nobody really thinks of usually as being comparable to the Romans. So the Romans are a true outlier in global terms. Now, this raises two obvious questions. Is what I just told you really true? Or are there ways of explaining away some of these anomalies and make the Romans look more normal? And the other question is, well, if it is true, how can we account for the state of affairs? Let's start with question one. Is it really true? Now, I can think of four possible objections. I'm sure people in the audience can think of more objections, and I'm sure you'll tell me later over lunch, but I'm going to stick to my four objections to preempt them. I suspect that for many people in the room or generally, it is tempting to challenge what I just said, my very broad brush, almost abstract arguments, with reference to points of detail. That, however, I should say up front, would be methodologically unsound, because whatever details you can come up with, they are already subsumed within the data sets that I've constructed. They're all accommodated within the averages that I have generated. But I understand this must be very tempting. So let me do it myself. For instance, you might say, how can I claim that the Romans didn't have proper dynasties? Everybody in this room knows that the Roman monarchy starts with a very famous dynasty, the Julio-Claudians, who last 100 years. And if you include Caesar, maybe last even a little longer. Well, that's a very good point because it reinforces my argument. If you look at a control group of about 50 dynasties in some of the main monarchies, you find they do on average last much longer. The average duration of this control group is 300 years per dynasty. The median is about 10 generations. So if the Julio-Claudians are the best that the Romans can do, they're doing a very, very poor job. And in fact, the Julio-Claudians are the best the Romans could do all the way up to, I think, the beginning of the second millennium in the Byzantine period. And of course, all the problems that characterize the system are already in place, right at the start. Three or four out of the first five emperors are killed. There is no other dynasty in world history in which three or four of the first five rulers die of unnatural causes. That's why I'm saying it actually reinforces the point. Now you could say, well, maybe the Romans were just unlucky. Everybody knows Augustus was desperate to set up a genuine dynasty based on kinship, right? Have a blood relative found a new dynasty, and he was just unlucky because he didn't have a son. So maybe there was something wrong with the Roman emperors. Maybe they didn't have enough children. Maybe they didn't have enough sex with their wives, or they had too much sex with young boys, or they had a low sperm count because they drank water contaminated with lead, or whatever. Well, that's not true either. A number of years ago, I did a study of emperors in the first 6 centuries of the monarchy, and I found that on average, emperors are survived by exactly as many sons and as many daughters as predicted by model life tables. So there's nothing wrong with the reproductive performance of Roman emperors. They have children, they just don't get to succeed them because of levels of violence. Well, the second objection is, well, maybe what I said is true for the first few centuries, but don't things change over time? If you open any textbook on Byzantium, well, the narrative will be organized in terms of dynasties. And if the East Romans had dynasties, well, maybe things had changed by then. To which the answer is, well, things changed a little bit, but not very much. In a 1,000-year period, there are 11 dynasties in Byzantine history lasting on average 91 years, which is 30% of the average in my control group. 60 out of the 68 emperors from Heraclius to Constantine the 11th, half are forcibly removed from power. The only progress is that some of them, instead of being killed, are mutilated and locked up, which I guess you could, you know, count as a kind of progress, but it doesn't really make a huge difference. In fact, if you add those 11 dynasties to my sample, you find they're all clustered at one tail end. They are exceptionally short by world historical standards. There's not a single Byzantine dynasty that lasts 200 years, whereas two-thirds of the dynasties in my control group last more than 200 years. So they're doing a little better than the Romans before, but not much. Well, the third objection is, well, maybe my entire approach is flawed because I operate with averages. And we all know that there is such a thing as the crisis of the third century, which is a 50-year period of crisis and dislocation where emperors last about 5 minutes before they are murdered. And so maybe if I include all these cases, this drags down the mean and it creates a specious impression of discontinuity and violence that's actually unfair. Well, the problem with this objection is I can't just produce a sanitized version of Roman history by removing the bits that make the Romans look different. What I can do is I can compare the Roman experience in times of crisis with the experience of other monarchies in times of crisis and instability. And guess what happens? Nothing changes, right? The Romans still do much more poorly than other monarchies in times of crisis, and the same is true of periods of relative stability. So no matter how I slice up the data, the overall picture is always the same. It simply doesn't change. The final objection concerns adoption. Well, you might say, why am I obsessing about kin-based succession if the Romans from Republican time onwards are quite happy to adopt people, sometimes kin, sometimes strangers, to succeed them, right? You have the adopted emperors in the second century and the tetrarchs and so on, all trying to do the same thing. Well, that's not really a solution because that fact by itself is part of the phenomenon. That is something that we also have to account for. In fact, what I did was my measure of unrelatedness that is very high among the Romans excludes cases of adoption. So this doesn't actually contribute to a solution of the problem. So unless some of you can think of more compelling objections, I believe that my claim is empirically correct and solid. And in fact, if you don't believe me, which I guess you shouldn't really, you can look up this article by a bunch of mathematicians who a few years ago used a very different method of arriving at basically the exact same result. They looked at the distribution of the mean duration of the reigns of Roman emperors. And this distribution is an exponential distribution that indicates a great degree of randomness and unpredictability and differs markedly from the distribution in other monarchies in a later European control group. So no matter what method you apply, you always get the same result. Having said that, I have to confess that what I just told you is almost true, but not quite. In actual fact, by relying on the raw data, it seems that I exaggerate just a little bit the difference between Romans and others. But this doesn't undermine my argument. In fact, it strengthens and reinforces my argument, which I guess I should explain. The problem is this. When I compiled my surveys, I had to take the data, the evidence at face value, which, as you all know, is a very bad idea, right? If someone is listed in the sources as having been killed, as assassinated, I classify this person accordingly. If there is no information about a killing, I have to assume that person died of natural causes. Now, this, of course, is egregiously naive because we never really know how rulers die. There's enormous motivation on the part of the people around them to get rid of them for whatever reason and install someone else instead. Now, this is a problem not just for the distant past, it's a problem all the way up to the present. When back in 1998, the Nigerian dictator Sani Abacha died in his sleep one night in his bedroom, nobody knew whether he died of a heart attack, which was the official cause of death, or whether one of the six teenage prostitutes who had spent the night with him had administered poison to remove him so that someone else could take over power. And if you can't tell for a case 13 years ago, we certainly can't tell for Roman emperors or other rulers in history. In fact, Robert Graves got a lot of mileage out of this in I, Claudius and Claudius God, imagining any number of secret killings usually perpetrated by Livia, starting with Augustus himself. However, in this case, I think Robert Graves was wrong. He chose the wrong target, and here's why. Again, a number of years ago, I did a study looking at Roman emperors who putatively died of natural causes. And I used what we know about their age at accession and their age at death to extrapolate back to their mean life expectancy at birth, which for this group is in the high 20s, which is very low by modern standards, but it's pretty much what we would expect for any ancient population. So there doesn't seem to have been any real difference between the life expectancy of Roman emperors who were not killed and the general population. And that's exactly what we would expect, because prior to the 18th century, no amount of wealth and power can really buy you better health and longer lives, because medicine is just not developed enough to make that happen. Now, the situation is similar in Byzantium. What is really striking is that in virtually all other monarchies that I have looked at, rulers who are not known to have been killed led significantly shorter lives than Roman emperors or Byzantine emperors who supposedly died of natural causes. Now, this is very, very strange because most of these monarchs led shorter lives not just compared to the Romans, but compared to the most unrealistically pessimistic model assumptions about life expectancy, with a mean life expectancy at birth of 18 years, which is so low it never actually occurs in practice. And yet this exceeds the performance of monarchs in most societies. Now, that's very, very strange. Most extreme instantiation is China, where emperors live about half as long as they were supposed to have lived. Now, this has been noted before by a bunch of physicians who attributed the short lives of Chinese emperors to their lifestyle. They ate too much, they drank too much, they had too many concubines and so on, so they got worn out and they died young. This, I think, illustrates very well the pitfalls of a particularistic approach to history. What these people were not aware of is that this is a truly global pattern. It happens almost everywhere except in the case of Rome. Now, there are various ways of accounting for this. One would be with reference to stress. There's a fair amount of literature regarding humans and other primates are showing that alpha males at the very top of the hierarchy are unusually stressed out because they constantly have to fret about losing power and rivals and so on. And so as a result, they are less healthy and may actually die younger. So maybe this accounts for what we see in the record. Well, the problem with this is that if that were true, then Roman emperors who were not killed, well, they should have been the most stressed out of all people because they lived in the most dangerous environment. So they should have led even shorter lives than everybody else and not significantly longer lives. So this can't really work either. I think there's a very economical explanation of explaining the entire pattern, which is that outside Rome, outside Byzantium, an unknowable but non-trivial percentage of all monarchs were secretly killed, but in a way that did not afterwards become publicly known. This is actually very plausible, because in most monarchies, killing a king or an emperor is a really big deal. This is not something you can easily get away with. So there's a very strong incentive for hushing things up to ensure a smoother succession. Now, in fact, what we would expect is a correlation between the extent to which a particular dynasty or monarchy is sort of exalted and sacred and sacrosanct and the likelihood of secret assassination. And that's exactly what we observe in the case of China, right? In China, the dynasty is of absolutely paramount importance. The emperor is a godlike figure, but also intensely sequestered, claustrated, removed from people's view, surrounded by people who can easily engineer a secret killing with nobody else noticing. And the same seems to be true to a lesser degree in other environments. Now, why am I telling you about this? I'm telling you about this because it reinforces my general argument about Roman exceptionalism. It's only in Rome, and to a lesser degree Byzantium, that it's apparently not such a big deal to kill a ruler openly and then maybe even succeed that individual. It's only in Rome where killers of emperors don't have all that much to worry about, at least compared to other monarchies, where there's a strong incentive to keep those things under wraps. That's why I think Robert Graves is wrong. When the Romans wanted to kill someone, they would do it openly. They didn't actually have to resort to secret poisonings. It's in all other monarchies that people have to resort to varying degrees to secret killings in order to remove their rulers. It's certainly not by coincidence that entire books can be written about the murder of Roman emperors, because you have so much information, so much of it becomes known and plays out in the open. Now, this raises an interesting question of cause and effect. Were open killings and takeovers by outsiders common because they were accepted, or were they accepted because they were so frequent, right? That leads us to the big final question, which is, of course, why? Can we account for this Roman anomaly? Luckily, I only have a few minutes left because I don't have a very compelling answer, which doesn't bother me very much because I wanted to establish the phenomenon as such, so you have something to think about and you can consider possible explanations. Now, ideally, what we would like in a perfect world is to find a variable with respect to which the Romans differed systematically from all other monarchies. Because if it could then be shown that this variable is somehow meaningfully related to the observed anomaly, well, that would be a great step forward. On the other hand, if we have to invoke 17 different reasons to explain the Roman case, well, that's a problem too, because that increases the likelihood that similar factors were present in other monarchies, and then we would have to explain why similar outcomes didn't occur elsewhere. Now, this may very well not be possible. It may not be possible to find a single variable that explains the entire anomaly for 1,500 years, but I think it's a reasonable starting point. Now, luckily for us, there's at least one such variable which every single person in this room already knows, which is the fact that the Roman monarchy is the only monarchy in my sample that grows out of a large, long-lived, successful republic. Now, this provides a superficially, and I emphasize superficially, appealing explanation. If Roman elites are used to frequent non-dynastic succession in their leadership, well, maybe they're not that much bothered about frequent assassinations, takeover by newcomers, and so on. In fact, it's striking to note that the myth of the seven kings of Rome already reflects this preference, where no king is the son of his immediate predecessor. It's very, very strange. Now, the problem with this explanation is that it's hard to see how the Republican legacy can account for 1,500 years of Roman history all the way up into Byzantium, unless it shaped the system so dramatically at the beginning to set it on a certain trajectory that it could not escape from. The other problem is that inasmuch as we have dynastic features, well, they occur early on, right, in the first century of the monarchy, when the Republican influence should have been stronger. So I'm not too happy with this explanation. I like the fact that this is a singular variable, but it may not explain all that much. Another possibility is, though, that the Republican legacy, whatever its effects were, was reinforced by the military takeover in the 3rd century AD, when members of the officer corps began to produce emperors directly and kept up this practice pretty much till the end of Roman history. That's relevant because, of course, the military is an institution that's used to high levels of violence and, again, to frequent non-kin succession, turnover, churn, mobility, and so on. So maybe this militarization of the rulership reinforced whatever effects the Republican legacy had. Now, I think there may be at least one other factor, variable aspect, in terms of which the Romans differed systematically from pretty much all other monarchies in my system, which is the fact that from day one, from Augustus onwards, the Roman Empire has for a long time, not for the whole 1500 years, but for a very long time, an unusually large standing professional army, which is increasingly geographically and culturally detached from the core regions of the Roman world. What this means is that people coming to power as emperors have ready access to a very useful means of coercion, which, all other things being equal, should increase their autonomy vis-a-vis other powerful constituencies. In many other monarchies, it's not enough to just go and kill a ruler and take over. You would have to do a lot of bargaining with other powerful people who have arms or money or priests and lords and so on in order to make things work. Romans don't have to do this. The only thing you have to do is kill the previous ruler, and inasmuch as the military supports you, you should be fine. So I think this is something that at least deserves further investigation. Many dynasties are set up by warlords, but the Romans are unique in that their system never sheds one of the crucial characteristics of warlordism, which is frequent violent turnover and open reliance on military resources. However that may be, my conclusion is quite straightforward. At the end of the day, being a Roman emperor was just a job. It was a fancy and hard to get and dangerous job, but it's really just a job. Roman emperors are not nearly as special as rulers are in all the other monarchies we have looked at, inasmuch it's so much easier to replace them by outsiders, by people who are not members of their kin group. Nothing that Roman emperors tried to do to break the cycle ever worked. Ruler cult has no impact on this. The later association of the person of the emperor with Christian divinity has no impact on this practice. Having more children, as some Byzantine emperors did, has no effect. What we face is an autocatalytic process, a self-sustaining, self-reinforcing cycle of violence and turnover that never properly goes away. If many people have the potential to be rulers, it's inevitable that some of them will try. And that by itself drives the whole process. Ready acceptance of murders and takeover by outsiders favors discontinuity. Discontinuity in turn favors ready acceptance of newcomers. Now, where do we go from here? I believe, I hope, I have successfully established the anomaly as such, the phenomenon that is in need of explanation, and I have no doubt less compellingly tried to suggest a few possible causal explanations. Now, none of this matters all that much to me because, as I said at the beginning, I'm not really interested in Roman emperors per se. What I'm interested in is the main point that none of this would have been possible without explicit systematic historical comparison. We would not have been able to establish, let alone measure, the extent of the anomaly, and we should also not try to come up with explanations. So you end up with a very simple, straightforward line of reasoning where you use data, but not just from the case study you're interested in. Data from all over the place, where comparison generates the problems, the questions that are really worth asking. And then in a second step, you have to rely on comparisons to come up with explanations that go beyond the level of conjecture that's uninformed, unconstrained by a broader global comparativist awareness. Now, this to me seems pretty much the best way of going beyond business as usual, beyond ancient history as we know it. So I guess the lesson for today is very simple. If you want to understand Roman emperors, stop studying Roman history. You probably already know everything you need to know about Roman history. Don't read another 50 books on the same topic. In general, if you're a classicist, don't buy the books that are on display outside. Buy your first book on a related subject that you don't know much about, because the rate of return on investment will be much higher. There's a very good chance that this will help you see your own subject, your own problems, in a new